Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Lickin' On Lending.
Welcome, everybody. Good to have you with us.
Welcome to Lickin' On Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news, all related to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Transformational Mortgage Solutions. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now here's your host of Lickin' On Lending, David Lickin.
Let's begin.
Welcome, everybody. It is Monday, and we are off to a great start. So much going on in the U.S. We'll talk about that some. But we've got, it's June 8th. I should always say that because for those of you listening on a downloaded basis, you got to know which one you're listening to. But anyway, this podcast is created by mortgage professionals. It is for mortgage professionals, and we're grateful to have you as our listener. Again, our commitment is to bring you timely information in an audio format, soon to be video and audio, that you can listen to or watch anytime, anywhere. We have Joe Murin going to be joining us in the Hot Topic segment. Joe is a good friend and is the past president of Ginnie Mae. He also serves as one of the advisors on Ainsworth Advisors, and we're just thrilled to have him here. I pre-recorded this, and he's going to be talking more about Ginnie Mae during the Great Recession. He's going to be he was actually president during the Great Recession of 2008 to 2009. I'm going to talk about that. This program is a privilege, and it's really what's going on with the pandemic and where the Ginnie Mae program should go. So Joe, again, a part of the Ainsworth Advisory Group, and in one of our calls, Joe and I were in the group, were talking, and Joe put out some things. I go, man, I wish I was recording that. And I said, would you come on the podcast and reshare that? So that's what we're going to do. We recorded it. You're going to really like this stuff. You're wondering where Ginnie Mae is going, where it needs to go. Joe Murin is going to be in the Hot Topic segment, and you're not going to want to miss it. I also want to say a special thank you to all of our sponsors. Oh, before we go, they got to mention two things we're a part of. Industry Syndicate, check it out, industrysyndicate.com, and Mortgage Media. I love what we're doing with both of these. Industry Syndicate, it seems to be more focused towards the loan originators, and they have a whole bunch of podcasts focused there, as well as realtors. Great place to check out kind of what are the thoughts going on, some real good thought leaders in the Industry Syndicate. And then Mortgage Media is designed more at the executive level. It's going out to everyone to the industry, but it's a good group of folks that we're thrilled to be partnered with and in Mortgage Media and playing a bigger and bigger role on how we work together. So check out mortgagemedia.com and be sure to check out Dave Matthews and my podcast. We have a new one going, The Two Daves, and it's perspective what's happening. And Dave's very much a good Democrat, and I'm a good Republican, so we get into some really wonderful discussion. We share that. We've been doing it for years, and we're now sharing it openly, and it is really fun. We have tremendous respect for each other. So I think you'll find how can you discuss with divergent views, how can you discuss things in an intelligent way that serves and comes together. So check out the Two Daves podcast. Special thank you to our sponsors, the Mortgage Bankers Association of America. Very good podcast we had with Bill Kelmer and Pete Mills on April 19th. Go check that out. Also, become a part of the Mortgage Action Alliance. Strongly encourage you to get signed up, a way to have your voice heard on important matters on the Hill. They represent us, and you can have your voice heard through the Mortgage Action Alliance app that you download it from the Play Store or from the App Store with your iPhone. Anyway, Finastra, who's also got their mortgage bot solution, we're doing some innovative things. I love the innovation that's coming out of Finastra. We're doing a series of videos and seminars out on their channel. And so go to the Finastra website. I love the leadership, the innovation that's going on at this company. We're pleased to have them be a part of us and the innovative things we're doing. Also, Lenders One and the Mortgage Collaborative, both of these co-ops do a great job of connecting lenders and vendors in a unique relationship. Love both the relationship with both of them. We just had Justin DeMolia on last week from Lenders One. Go back and listen to that podcast. Also, the CMLA, or the Community Mortgage Lenders of America, great organization. Also, Indicom, they do a great job. That's Alice's old employer. They came on and became a sponsor of the podcast. Great outsourcing solution. We're thrilled to have them as an advertiser, as well as Incelerate. Josh does such a good job. Josh Friend at Accelerate has done some of the most innovative ways of engaging borrowers. You got to check out their website, Accelerate.com, as well as Ainsworth Advisors. Again, we're talking with Joe Murin, who's part of that. Gives you a little insights into Ainsworth Advisors. Check that out, as well as AI Assist, a way of you connecting with consumers. Celebrity Home Loans, growing through acquisitions, looking for a new home, looking for a place to go with your company. If you're selling, check out Celebrity Home Loans, as well as Knowledge Group for a great LMS, learning management system, as well as Mobility RE and how you can connect and recruit top LOs, as well as Modex. They're a great complement. We have had Ben Terlink on with Mobility RE, and we've had Dale the Third and Dale Jr. on, and 2 weeks ago. It's a great podcast, great words. Also, Velma, VendorServe, Vidyard, say thank you to all of you for your sponsorship. And then a special thank you goes out to Alice, Andy, Allen, and Matt, the newest contributor to our podcast. For those that are listening on a downloaded basis, you'll hear Rob Van Raphorst. No, we did not get it in time to include it. So be sure to go back and listen on a downloaded basis to what the MBA turned in. But let's get over to Les Parker with this week's TM Spotlight and the macro view of the markets.
TM Spotlight Soundbites is brought to you by Power Seller, making hedging easy.
Crazy.
We're crazy, crazy for coupons.
So lonely.
Stocks soar like sparks rather than fall like rocks. Why do markets often defy the public's consensus? Since March, when the Federal Reserve restarted buying mortgages, rates have dropped. Mortgage investors anticipate that borrowers will refinance. With loan rates concentrated between 2.75% and 3.75%, a lot of consumers will refinance at the same time. Once the 2% coupon becomes popular, then mortgage rates will be 2.25% to 2.75%. They'll go crazy with loving. Two, these views are my own. Go to tmspotlight.com to subscribe to my daily newsletter.
That's a nostalgic old song, Les Parker, you do, and Gary Canterbone. Good job of producing that. I love that. Nostalgic. Yeah, it's crazy what's going on out there. Crazy what's going on in our streets. Crazy what's going on with the rides. Crazy what's happening. It's just amazing how the markets just are keep moving forward and rates are dropping. I just refinanced my mortgage in October and rates are down. I got a notification that I can reduce my 30-year fixed rate down to 2.625%. And I'm going to jump on that. So crazy. Reminds me back of 2003, somewhere around there. Crazy times. But anyway, let's get over to check over tmspotlight.com. Sign up for Les's free email. You'll hear a music parody or you'll read about a music parody each and every week, each and every day. Matt Graham, so good to have you here live with us. We got your recorded comments last week, and then we had you come on. And you're going to be our Hot Topic guest on next Monday's program. So we're excited to have you here and continue to give us an update. What you got for us this week, Matt?
Excited to be here. Thanks, Dave. So, yeah, talking about mortgage rates dropping, your 2.625% quote you got, you might want to make sure that's still lockable today. Rates jumped up quite a bit at the end of last week on a relative basis, of course. But there's a really interesting dichotomy between last week and this week. So last week, my little recorded spiel I sent you talked about the fact that, you know, things were really flat in the bond market. And that the market wasn't responding to economic data, or that it would tune out economic data until the economic data made a loud enough case to be heard. And that's really what happened last week, arguably, especially on Wednesday. And
with the jobs report,
there was first kind of a prelude to the jobs report that made people brace for impact. And part of that was the ISM non-manufacturing data on Wednesday.
Yeah.
ISM is probably a little bit underappreciated by the average loan officer who is following economic data for the purpose of staying on top of interest rates. But apart from NFP, non-farm payrolls, the big jobs report, the ISM reports are some of the most reliable, biggest market movers we have. And they offer a really good way to track the rebound in the economy coming back from coronavirus. And that report, not necessarily the headline, but the business activity component was much stronger than expected and got all the way back up to 41 on an index basis. And the forecast was for 34. And this is coming back from a rating of 26 in the previous month. But that was that was second fiddle to the morning's big data, which was ADP employment. So just a little background on that. ADP's stated goal with that report is to try to capture and predict what the second revision of the non-farm payrolls, the big jobs number, will be. And it comes out 2 days before. So over the years, recent years, because it's not as old of a report, it's gained a love it or hate it reputation as being either predictive or completely useless, depending on whom you ask. But certainly we would have to conclude that, you know, given ADP's role in the payroll processing marketplace, they definitely have a finger on the pulse of how many payrolls are going out. So if there's variability in their data, I think it comes more from, you know, trying to predict NFP than it does from not having access to good data themselves. In any event, the thing absolutely crushed its forecast. It came in at, quote unquote, only negative 2.7 million, which, you know, of course, everything's relative. When it comes to economic data, forecasters were expecting negative 9 million. That makes that the biggest ever beat, the biggest difference between a forecast and an actual number for that ADP report. Combined with ISM a couple hours later, You have this flat bond market that wasn't really tuned into economic data, that's sort of waiting for some sort of big information to come down the pike. And here it comes all at once on Wednesday morning, forcing the bond market to consider, holy crap, maybe we have been too complacent or too bearish on the economy, and maybe we need to prepare for the economy coming back online a little bit quicker than we thought. And that kicked off a little bit of a chain reaction that pushed Treasury yields especially higher. And then Thursday, it was just pure momentum trading. You had a lot of anticipation for and repositioning for Friday's big jobs number, because traders were thinking, sure, ADP sometimes misses the mark when it comes to predicting NFP, but if it's this far from forecast, we have to prepare for the possibility that NFP, non-farm payrolls, does the same thing. And indeed, not only did it do the same thing, it took it to the next level. NFP might be the biggest. It might be the biggest beat we ever see in our lifetimes. No way to say that for sure, but I think for the time being, and certainly looking back into the past, it's the biggest beat we could imagine. Came in at positive 2.5 million versus a negative 8 million forecast, and you know, we definitely have jobs that need to come back into the economy, so it's not a surprise to see the capability of the economy to generate that kind of payroll growth, because it destroyed so many payrolls in the previous couple months. But to see it so soon and so much better than expected added to this case that the bond market was sort of caught flat-footed and needed to prepare for the possibility, at least, that this first phase of the economic recovery will be faster than expected. So with that, we had 3 days of extreme, not necessarily extreme, but relative to the last 6 to 9 weeks, extreme movement in Treasury yields. The nice thing, the saving grace here, is that MBS fared better by comparison, mortgage-backed securities. And there are a couple reasons for that. First off, you know, Treasuries will first and foremost bear the brunt of any, you know, bond market specific news. Anything that is hitting that risk on, risk off sort of buy stock, sell bond sort of thing, they're going to sell Treasuries first, and MBS will be less affected comparatively. Also, Treasuries have much more supply concern right now, and what I mean by that is the government is issuing a ton of Treasuries in order to pay for stimulus programs and to make up for revenue shortfall. And then we also have the corporate bond market right now going absolutely nuts, record corporate bond issuance.
Yeah.
So on one hand, that creates an alternative investment that creates competition for, you know, Treasury and MBS, but it also is it also implies some short-term selling in the Treasury market due to the way corporate bonds are priced and sold, and the companies that help these corporations issue their bonds effectively lock their rate for them the same way that a mortgage lender could lock a rate by taking a short position in MBS. They take a short position in treasuries because treasuries serve as the foundation for those corporate borrowing rates. And so it creates short-term selling pressure in treasuries, which can drive rates up. Then depending on what the market's doing, the book runners, as they're called, the companies that help the corporations issue these bonds, may or may not buy those hedges back. And so at the very least, it's a 50-50, it's a wash, but sometimes it ends up being negative for treasuries. Anyway, back to the point, MBS don't have those concerns. They're not used as a hedge for corporate bonds. They're not being issued any more rapidly than is suggested by refinance demand. So they're able to outperform. Mortgage rates themselves also have a very historically wide gap between where they are and where mortgage bonds say they should be. And that has to do with a lot of coronavirus-specific stuff, the forbearance tidal wave, cost concerns and cash flow concerns that lenders have never had to deal with before. So that's keeping rates elevated relative to MBS, and it was really the only reason over the past 6 weeks that mortgage rates were able to fall, even as Treasury yields sort of ground gently higher during that time. Anyway, the big concern here is that, well, it's not a concern for the economy. It's a great thing for the economy, but the concern for mortgage rates.
For bonds,
Is that all of a sudden here we are on the precipice of a faster than expected recovery. And yes, this is definitely a source of major debate. And a lot of people want to say, you know, how dare the stock market be going this high? And how could people think we're going to have a recovery? Because it's awful out there. I'm not offering an opinion on that. I'm just saying the bonds are reacting to the data they have available. And it's better than they thought it would be. And, we have to defend against the possibility that this is going to continue to move in an upward direction for rates. And I think it's safe to say either way, that if the economic data were to continue to paint the same picture it painted last week, that there would be a certain measure of upward pressure on rates. And if there's anything pushing back, it's the Fed. And we have the Fed coming up this Wednesday. And a lot of people are expecting them to firm up their bond buying commitment because in March they embarked on emergency bond buying that they've been adjusting as needed. And they've settled into adjusting that every Friday. And this Friday was the first time since they started this that they haven't made a change to their daily maximum amount for MBS buying. So it was $4.47 billion a day. That might offer us some small clue as to what they will solidify this Wednesday, if they do solidify something. There's no inherent implication for what that would do for rates, but it does give us a baseline, a benchmark to assess how generous or stingy they're being if they announce QE4. Really, it would be official QE.
Yeah, QE4, yeah.
And that's really the big focus of this week. Not a ton of economic data on tap. Definitely nothing like last week in that regard, and I think all eyes are really on the Fed.
Matt, I'm on your website right now looking at it, and the live news stream, there's so many features on your website that I just want people to be aware of and go try, sign up for a free trial on this system. Because if you want to know what's the latest news happening out there, it's right here. It's got all news, it's alerts, videos, and then also the MBS live chat. It is just such a well-designed place to go for an immense amount of information. So kudos to you, and I can't wait for our listeners to all sign up for your service, Fred. Appreciate you, and thank you so much for being here.
I'll get you a Lickin' Link, too, so that people
get
can
a Lickin' Link.
Get an extra discount, extra free time.
That's excellent. That's excellent. Well, thanks so much for being a part of the podcast, joining us now, and looking forward to having you here each and every Monday. And so, folks, get a hold of Matt. Take a look at what he's got to offer. It's just really cool. All right. Appreciate you, Matt. Have a great week. Check it out, mbslive.net, not .com, net, mbslive.net. Matt, thanks again. Let's get over to Alice Alvey. Alvis live with us. We just love it when Alice can be here live. It makes such a – I just love her energy. Alice, good to have you here. Alice is the CMB Vice President of Education and Training for Bill Cosgrove's company, Bill and Alice Conference Company called Union Home Mortgage, and she's got this week's legislative update. Alice, how you doing there, my friend?
I am doing well, Jay. Thanks. Nice report, Matt. I was listening intently, and then you know, now we'll be watching it closely to see what really happens. So thanks. It's great to have you on the program with us.
You bet. Thank you.
You're welcome. So a couple of quick things. The OCC is also sent a letter to the state associations, the governors and the mayors and so forth, to try and get them to recognize, you know, that these lockdowns, even to the extent, I know some states are opening it back up. I'm in Ohio. We're actually kind of on the better side compared to some of the other states, but we still have a lot of restrictions. And so the OCC was sending out a notice. They sent that out last week to make sure that the governors really think about the impact, in particular to commercial real estate as tenants struggle. And as you have vacancies and you have stores that are now going out of business, the commercial side of our industry is really going to probably feel the hit much more so than the residential side, since borrowers that they have been able to refi. So obviously then what starts to happen is the house bills that are coming in are also very tenant focused for helping them. And so there seems to be a perfect storm brewing for commercial real estate that we'll have to watch. You know, if you don't have tenants, you can't maintain. If the place is vacant, it becomes subject to vandalism. So, you know, they're really trying to push that these states get opened back up to help those businesses. So they were trying to push that button to see if that works. We'll watch. I think the main memo I'd like to focus on is the HUD mortgagee letter 2016 that came out. Now, when people see that there's forbearance and HUD's going to take forbearance, the sales side often starts asking a lot of questions. Does this mean I can close a loan if the borrower wanted to go in forbearance? The answer to that is still absolutely not. When a loan closes, they have to have a job, and we have to know that they're going to be able to meet all the requirements of all the financing. Even this new FHA mortgagee letter says the same thing. So at the time the forbearance was initiated, the mortgage had to be current, which means they at least made one payment. They had to give us one payment before they asked. You know, you have some customers asking before you even close. No, what happens if I decide I want to go into forbearance? So I think the thing with the HUD,
so
right?
Funny.
Yeah, what, Brian? I don't know if I am, but and you never quite know what to say about that as an originator. So anyway, the idea is that the loan was current. By the time we closed the loan, everything was in compliance. So folks out there who keep hearing rumblings of leniency, it really is that gap between we closed the loan, they made a payment, and now they're going, okay, I'm struggling. I'm not going to be able to make it. Certainly they're eligible for all the new easy relief stuff going on. What HUD did was come up with a 2-year partial indemnification agreement. So the lender has to be able to, before they send in for endorsement, provide an additional statement that supplements the warranty that's made on the HUD application that says, yes, everything was accurate at the time of closing. So there's an extra form as a lender we have to sign as you walk through that process. If the borrower then becomes 60 days delinquent, it's a partial indemnification of 20% of the loan amount. So a little bit of relief. And I think the second part, Dave, I just want to focus on for folks is they're really looking for relief. Okay, if my borrower decided to go into forbearance, I can't take the loan application now. What if they're current and they get current? Then what can I do? Is it going to be 12 months for that group before they can come back and apply? That's where the agencies have said 3 months. So we do have some conventional that we do get a little bit of leeway. As people start going back to work, have them show us they can make 3 payments on time. You're not going to have to wait 12. And that'll be probably the biggest win that we get out of all of this so far. You still got to have job stability. That part didn't go away. So anyway, that's my 2 cents, Dave, on where we're still kind of struggling with employment and income as all of this keeps us in lockdown and folks are struggling.
That's worth so much more than 2 cents. A lot of the information there, Alice. And again, if you want to listen to Alice's comments or any of the comments, Matt's, anyone's here that we have, you could go to our website and go to specifically each individual's contribution is in their own page on the website, the Lincoln Lending website. And you can listen to all of Alice's comments. A lot of people go back and listen and to each one of the segments because there's things that they're said. So, Alice, great update as always. Good to have you back live, and we just appreciate you so much. Thank you. Appreciate you. She's my mortgage sister, everybody. She is my mortgage. She and her husband are just dear, dear friends. Anyway, let's get on over to Alan Pollack. Good to have you here. Yeah, Alan, before we do, I just want to say, you know, I love innovation. That's what Alan's whole talks about is innovation. What's happening out there? And you got to check out what's happening at Finastra, some of the innovation they're doing. I'm getting to be a part of some podcasts, or communication videos that they're going to be pumping out about, and it's being done in an innovative way. Folks, when you're looking for a partner, get with one that is innovative. Finastra's got some great stuff going. So, Alan, good to have you here with us. You're another innovative guy.
Thank you.
Alan, Alan.
I like to.
There we are.
Like to innovate time to time.
Yeah.
Good afternoon.
You animate and you innovate. That's true. That's great.
That's right.
Good to have you.
Yeah. Good to be here as always. So this is a great one. You ready? I'm going to kick us off with something funny. So
okay.
How would you like to have the prior cell phone of Elon Musk? Well, there, I'm sure you'd love to have it. The NPR has a funny article. There is a girl. She's 25 years old. Didn't even know who Elon Musk was at first. She's a skincare consultant, and she had his number. And at first, she didn't know who he was. She was getting all kinds of weird phone calls and messages, and she asked her mom who this Elon Musk guy was, and her mom's mouth dropped. And here's some of the things she gets messaged to her. She gets one person wanted to go to SpaceX. She gets many per day, by the way. There's just a couple here. One person wanted to go to SpaceX. One person sent her a blueprint for a bionic limb that they want to create with him. Someone in South Africa wants to buy 1,000 of his new SUVs. The IRS called. She thought first that she did something wrong. It turns out they had an Elon Musk tax issue. So she had to let them know that she's not Elon. Former Walt Disney executive texted her and said, "This Tesla is magnificent. Thank you very much." And she even had to apologize to his dad for never calling him back. So very, very funny.
That's so funny.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a lot of, you know, popular people whose prior cell phones and even addresses, you know, get in the hands of others. So very, very interesting.
Yep.
So we talk a lot about Simple Nexus. I didn't realize a friend actually just told me they've got a lot of integrations. Anyways, they just released what they're calling their closing portal to help lenders meet their urgent consumer demand for mobile mortgage closing solutions. Sound like a commercial, right? Well, anyways, you want to check it out. Simple Nexus has a lot of great things going on, truly innovative. And the great thing about it is, you know, you use your point of sale to talk to borrowers, to do different tasks, to stay in sync. The closing process, there's no reason why they should go somewhere else. So if you have the ability to put those things together that fits within your workflow, then it's a home run. So check out Simple Nexus. IndyCom, David. IndyCom,
yes,
Global Services.
Our sponsor.
That's right. Well, hello
our
to IndyCom.
Sponsors.
So they just announced the launch of their retail version of what they call Income Genius. It's income calculation automation software. And why is this important? Man, anything we can do on the back end to reduce time, reduce errors, and verify, especially in times like today where we have an influx of applications and there's questions around eligibility and credit risk and you name it, Income Genius is an awesome tool. It sounds awesome. So you want to check it out. I know there's some others that have it. We'll probably hear more that have tools like this, but this is, to me, this is a big deal. If you get the right data and you can fine-tune this process to fit within your workflow, then this is where you're going to save some time. So check it out, IndyCom Global Services. David, tickets, right? I'm not as I can't sing as well as Les, so I'm just going to leave it at that, right? But this is an issue that we all have with vendors, right? We've got many vendors, sometimes 15, 20, 30 different vendors. Different parts of our operation are dealing with different vendors, and we've got these tickets. And it's enhancements, it's things don't work, it's we need to see something a different way. This has been a crazy year. Right. It started off. We talked about getting your tech in shape. You truly need to think about what are you going to do for the rest of the year. And with the focus truly moving towards where we want to be, which is the front end of the process, because we need to support more expectations of the borrower. And a lot of us have done it, but we need to get there. I just want to give you a couple things that you need to think about. We need to take a look at the different tickets that we have that we put out for our vendors. Some are many months old. And some of them may not even apply anymore. Things change,
wow.
Our needs change, It may even be that we have different folks within our organization, like the credit department, the underwriting department, the closing department, and they're having things done to the technology that our vendors support that may not necessarily be what each other need in concert. So it's time to bring that all back in. We're all slowly getting back to some type of new normal. Figure out what are all those tickets you have out there. Let's look at what is the workflow and what are we trying to do? Let's verify and reprioritize those tickets. Let's help the vendors help us, because the vendors get inundated. They have hundreds of tickets all the time, and they can only deal with so many. The other thing to think about is set up a call with those vendors to review them and look at maybe there's folks, different things that have enhanced or happened at those vendors' integrations or their platform that they provide you with that have changed and you don't know. You can leverage it, new configurations, new ways to use it. So open the lines of communication, reset expectations, and revise your plan. This may help you tackle the rest of this year and the new norm a lot easier. So we did not, David, talk about, and by the way, maybe Les can do a song for tickets, tickets, tickets next week. That'd be great. We did not talk about the adoption rates of technology. I'll do that for next week. I know we talked about it. I would do it for this week. But the tickets, something happened to me last week that I thought this would just be a fantastic topic and so relevant for all of us getting back to this new norm. So the only other thing I want to leave us with is, and I always say fantastic content at Housing Wire, another fantastic article. It is basically it's called How COVID-19 Pandemic Kickstarted the Digital Innovation in Mortgage. It's from the head of fulfillment at City Mortgage. It's chief operating officer at Loan Depot. It's consumer direct sales and business insights manager at Wells Fargo. And it was moderated by Tata Consulting Services. Anyways, they talked about a lot of great things, but you want to know two quotes, what they said that we'll leave today's session with that thought were fantastic. One, pre-qualifying customers has never been easier with online applications. Nobody wants to go face-to-face right now, so focusing on consumer direct is so important. And then second, I thought I'd mention that Loan Depot mentioned in this on this panel here that they did a virtual job fair, and we mentioned it, David. They were able to hire 400 employees. They had over 10,000 people join the virtual job fair.
I saw that. It's crazy.
So if you think about, we need people for underwriting, closing, support, everything. So, and a lot of others are supporting, you know, hiring right now. So anyways, I hope you have a great week in technology, and looking forward to today's hot topic.
Good job. Yeah, thanks so much. If you want to ask or get a hold of Alan, get a hold of him at Alan, A-L-L-E-N, at tms-advisors.com. Yep, he's one of our advisors on the technology front. Does a great job. He works also at Open Close, and they're a great, another great technology company. So shout out to them as well. Appreciate you, Alan, for being here. Love it.
Likewise.
Very much. You bet. Dr. Andy Schell, the Profit Doctor, could not be with us live, but he sent in a pre-recorded audio for today's program. So let's get over to hear what Andy had to say for us. Andy?
Hi, Dave. It is great to be on Lickin' on Lending again. This is Dr. Andy Schell, the Profit Doctor, and today I am going to talk about knowing your numbers, accounting, like going to the dentist. We hate it, but we know we need to. So here's a quick side note. I'm visiting my in-laws, and yesterday I was on a big pontoon boat with my brother-in-law out in the middle of a huge lake in Tennessee. And after about an hour or so, I noticed that the gas gauge on the boat was on empty. So I asked my brother-in-law, how much gas do we have? And he said, well, I put in some gas last week, and then I drove 5 or so hours or so, something like that. So we should have enough. And I thought to myself, I'd really rather not have to paddle by hand a pontoon boat half a mile, 3/4 of a mile down a lake. So I thought to myself, I would rather have a gas gauge. So you may think, well, how does this relate to knowing your numbers? Think about the mortgage company that every month end has to have enough money to run payroll, has to have enough money to close all of the loans that are scheduled to close and contribute the necessary funds to get everything closed. So every mortgage company then needs a gas gauge to be able to talk about how much cash is left, how much cash is left at the end of the month. Do we have enough cash in order to fund all of our month-end transactions? So I like it when mortgage companies have a cash flow dial, just like a gas gauge, but it's for money that we have available to spend on things for the business to keep everything running smoothly. As we all know, mortgage companies go through a lot of cash, borrowing money to fund the loan, receiving cash when the loan is sold. Lots of cash flow goes through the company, but surprisingly, there's actually a demand for cash within a mortgage bank. So it's important to have your finger on the pulse or your eye on the cash flow dial, especially at month end and in and through the first week of the month until all the loans are purchased or loan purchase activity accelerates. And if you're thinking about retaining servicing, which a lot of folks are, that's a tricky issue because the profit may show that we made a point and a quarter on the servicing, but in a cash flow basis, there won't be any cash. Mortgage servicing rights is a non-cash event. So again, you can't spend MSR, you can't spend mortgage servicing rights. So you have to have cash flow. So that's where we need to make sure that our dial is adjusted so that we do have enough cash to support our activity, even when we are retaining servicing. So all of this is part of the simple steps to a healthy business by me, Dr. Andy Schell, the Profit Doctor, the book that I'll be releasing soon. It's always a pleasure, Dave, to join the Lickin' On Lending team and to speak to the Lickin' On Lending listeners. Thanks for listening. I hope everybody has a great week.
Thanks, Andy. That's a good analogy about the being out on the boat. How many times? Well, I filled up the gas last week. Well, how many times have you had the boat out? Well, that's no different than, okay, I had a lot of money when I checked to the bank last month or last week, and then how much there? So cash utilization is always a challenge. Number of people that don't understand that in our industry is quite astounding. Good job, Andy Schell. Appreciate it. Welcome, and thank you for what you're doing, and safe travels back, and look forward to having you back here. He's my sponsor for my CMB exam, so I'm excited about that. Andy Schell can be reached at Dr. Schell, S-C-H-E-L-L, doctor spelled out, by the way, at mbs-team.com. Good to have him with us. Folks, that wraps up this week's mortgage banking update. We're going to immediately go right into the hot topic segment. So stay tuned. For those of you listening on a downloaded basis, you just go right on into the next podcast, which will be the hot topic segment. For those of you who are listening live, stay tuned, because we're now getting into the Lickin' On Lending Hot Topic segment. I'm excited to have with us today Joe Murin. Joe has been our guest in times past. He's also recorded a segment or an interview on the Lickin' On Leadership podcast. Go check that out. Yep, we got one of those podcasts. Very, very good. And that is downloaded so much. There's so much wisdom in Joe Murin and what he has to share. He serves on a lot of boards. He serves on our Ainsworth Advisory Board Service, so check it out, ainsworthadvisors.com. But we're now got a comment with Joe, an interview that we recorded, so let's get right into it. Folks, I'm excited to have Joe Murin joining us. He is chairman of JJAM Financial Services. We're going to hear about that in just a minute. But Joe has a distinguished career in the industry, the most prominent in the area that's of his background that we're going to talk and focus on today. He is the past president of Jenny May. And Joe is also a part of Ainsworth Advisors. It's an advisory board services firm where we provide advisory services as a board to mortgage bankers, typically independent mortgage bankers, but oftentimes more and more banks are showing interest. And you can take a look at Joe's profile there on ainsworthadvisors.com. It's a real honor to have Joe here with us today. Also, I'd call your attention to the Lickin' on Leadership podcast. You can go to lickinonleadership.com and look for Joe Mearns at Season 2, January 30th, 2019. And we did an interview and got his perspective on leadership. I just noticed as we're recording this today, it was downloaded 2 more times and listened to today. Very popular podcast. Joe, it's good to have you with us. Appreciate you taking time.
Well, it's always a pleasure, David. It's nice, especially at my age, to still have some relevance in the industry.
No, you do. Well, I think what we failed to learn from history, we're doomed to repeat. You and I have been through, and I've been at this for 47 years, and you've got a number of decades underneath your belt. I think it's a 40 plus as well, if I'm not mistaken.
50, yeah. Almost 50 years, yeah.
Yeah, my gosh.
5 decades.
Yeah. Yeah, 5 decades is a long time. I'm almost there. So I'll be chasing you down that path. But we're grateful to have you here today. And I want to talk about something that we talked on a recent Ainsworth Advisory Board. We published, folks, a snippet of what you would hear if you retain Ainsworth Advisors. And as we were talking about that, it was just before or just after we recorded what you'll hear on the website. I encourage you to go listen to that. Again, check out ainsworthadvisors.com. But Joe really started vocalizing his passion about Jenny May, and that's what we're going to talk about. So, Joe, thank you so much for being here, and I'm excited to get into this topic. Sure. You are passionate about Jenny May, the Jenny May program, and I want to get an understanding of why. What is it that is got you a bit stirred up?
Well, I mean, first of all, to be able to be a part or be an approved issuer of the Jenny May program is certainly a gift, because any time that you're in this business and you can control your liquidity destiny, I think that's a gift. And I think that a lot of folks don't really understand how important that is. I mean, they go through the motions, put their pools together, but they really don't understand how important it is to be able to have the control over your own liquidity. And I think that's why I'm so passionate about it, because it's such an important tool for the mortgage banking industry, especially when you're in the Ginnie program and you're dealing with, you know, people in need, FHA programs, our veterans under the VA, the folks under the USDA program. I mean, these are not high profile individuals or borrowers. These are mom and pop borrowers who struggle every day. And they're taking advantage of an FHA program, or their veterans taking advantage of the VA program, and you have the ability to service them and then control the liquidity so you can go out and service them again. So that's why I'm so passionate, David, about the business and the industry. And quite frankly, I'm a little bit disturbed about it today, but you know, I'm hoping that it'll come back around to where it needs to be, and we'll have to wait and see.
Well, let's talk about where it needs to be in just a minute, but let's talk about why you are disturbed right now. What are the things you're seeing about the Jenny May program that concerns you?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think the Jenny May program, to become part of the Jenny May program, the requirements are too lenient. Anybody with a net worth of $2.5 million can become eligible. Well, $1 million in equity to become eligible for a program like Jenny May is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, because the vast majority of $1 million in equity, you know, means that there's really no liquidity in the in that client's balance sheet. So, you know, how are they going to be responsible for putting pools together? How are they going to be responsible for managing the delinquency and being able to use, and if they're retaining the MSRs and being able to accommodate the pass-through requirements? It's just impossible for that to happen. And when I look at the Ginnie Mae program today and I see $2 trillion worth of outstandings, and 70 to 75% of that $2 trillion is held by non-depository type issuers, that's a real big concern for me. And so what I don't want to happen is for something traumatic to happen to that program. And then all of a sudden, you know, the folks in our legislature zero in on it, and all of a sudden the program ends up being something that you really don't want it to be. So I have a problem with that. We need a lot of work to be done on the Ginnie program to make it a program that's as important as it needs to be able to provide the service it provides to the mortgage industry. And there's nothing more important in the mortgage industry than to be able to have access to liquidity.
Joe, the recent events with the pandemic has really shined a light on how critical it is people understand the importance of liquidity. Talk about this event. And it doesn't take a black swan event such as the pandemic to really challenge and bring this important point home. Why are you so passionate about having a greater liquidity than $2.5 million? And what should it realistically be? Is there a number you have in your mind?
Well, I think it's a couple of things, David. First of all, if you have, you know, when you have a $2 trillion portfolio and the vast majority of the issuers supporting that portfolio do not have the liquidity requirements, then that in itself can be a catastrophic event. It doesn't take a pandemic to do it. It just takes a recession. So, you know, it's if I don't have the ability to convert some of my assets to liquid cash so that I have the ability to pass through, or if I don't have the ability to go out and create lines of credit to be able to take the pass, you know, to be able to pay the pass-throughs, then it's problematic. And Ginnie can only do so much. When I left office, we were somewhere around $860 billion, and I think we were at 18% with non-depository issuers, which was relatively safe. Today, it's just ballooned out of proportion, and I think that's the biggest thing I worry about is not having that program because it gets out of hand and something catastrophic happens.
Yeah. You're talking about a lot of independent mortgage bankers, non-regulated institutions that are now contributing into that program, and that's where the concern is those entities. Define that for some of our listeners, why you're not as concerned about it for the regulated institutions and more so, I know it's fairly obvious, but for those that are newer to the industry, I'd like to have you walk them through that.
Well, you know, if you have a depository institution that's an issuer, they have access to deposits. So they always have liquidity that they have access to. Non-depositories aren't in the same type of business, so they don't have easy access to liquidity. And that's the problem. And if they have to come up with the pass-through payments, the P&I, every month because they have delinquencies out there, or in this case, it's forbearance issues out there, then it's a compounding problem that there's no end to it. And so I think that, you know, ultimately, you know, the banks backed away from the FHA program a few years ago just because it was, you know, they weren't comfortable with the Department of Justice. So they backed away. So when the Chases or the Cities or all those guys, when they kind of get out of the Ginnie Mae business, that even puts a bigger emphasis on the potential problem that those Ginnie pools can have. So, from my perspective, I think a couple things have to happen. Number one, I think Ginnie needs to be able to really improve on its acknowledgement agreement, because the institutions that you talk to relative to being able to feel comfortable enough to lend money on the MSRs, whatever value they're going to value them at, it's too cumbersome to go through this Ginnie process. You know, and this goes all the way back to when I was in office in 2008, 2009. It's a cumbersome process that most people don't like. And so Ginnie really has to really sit down and go through this and figure this out. The second thing they need to do is, yes, I think $2.5 million is not enough equity. But more importantly, what's the liquidity capital ratio that issuer has? And what does that mean? Well, I mean, you may have a $2.5 million net worth. That doesn't mean that those assets are liquid or relatively liquid. So what's your liquidity ratio? And how do you calculate the liquidity ratio? So I think Ginnie needs to come up with a capital liquidity ratio that every issuer needs to have. So most issuers, when they get into business that are non-depositories, they accumulate MSRs. You know, and that's nice as long as everything is going fine. Today, what's the MSR values in today's pandemic environment? Not too good, not too definable. Very, very difficult to create liquidity to sell those MSRs. Most issuers think, oh, it's not a problem, I'll just sell MSRs. No, it's not that easy. In tough times, it is not a very liquid instrument. And if it is a liquid instrument, it's pennies on the dollar. So you can't depend on the liquidity of your MSR portfolio to bail you out when you have to have pass-through payments. It's like, you know, having margin calls, you don't have any money for the margin calls. It's the same principle. So I think that they have to be able to create a capital liquidity structure that every issuer needs to have, especially if they're retaining their MSRs, or every new issuer that doesn't have that capital requirement, they at least have to be able to liquidate those MSRs and not hold on to those MSRs until they meet that standard. So something has to happen, because all we're doing is kicking a can down the road and hoping this thing don't blow up on us.
Any thoughts on originator? Let's say there are 5 million. The biggest concern I have about having a stated net worth is a really good originator can outproduce their coverage, even though they may have $20 million net worth. It's possible that they can originate and have so many MSRs out there that they outstrip their ability to support them should something like what we're going through right now, the COVID pandemic.
You're absolutely right. So when you take a look at that, in cases like we have today, when refis are making money hand over fist with these refis programs. And when you think about it, David, we've really been in the refi market since 2001. So from my perspective, a lot of the new issuers that have come on board in that last 20-year period have not really done anything more than just become an originator of refi business. I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying that's easy money. I think the other thing Ginny has to do is to make sure that they don't outstrip themselves. So they can somewhat control that by how much, you know, authority they give them when they're requested. So if you see their capital ratio is X and they're asking for X in commitment authority, I'm not going to give you $1 billion. I'll give you $500 million or whatever it might be. They can control that to some degree. And the problem, and I don't want to speak for them because it's been a while since I've been involved in the nuts and bolts of Ginnie Mae, but it doesn't appear that that's happening. It might be in certain cases, but it necessarily doesn't appear what it's happening. But I don't think if it is happening, it isn't happening from the standpoint of being able to correlate between the capital requirement for liquidity needed against the portfolio that they have outstanding. So I think there has to be some work done there. Congress needs to get serious and HUD needs to get serious about giving Ginnie Mae the personnel it needs to be able to manage the risk. It didn't happen before I was in office. It didn't happen while I was in office, and it certainly still hasn't happened. So if we're going to run a multi-trillion dollar industry, then we certainly have to have the experience and the personnel to be able to do that. And right now, Ginny doesn't have that.
Yeah. And that's something you've been advocating for. Everyone has been advocating for one reason. Yeah. And it's just not allocated. We'll talk about that in a minute. You said there are 3 points to the improvement of the agreement, the $2.5 million net worth coming up with some type of capital liquidity requirements, like the idea of liquidity ratios and giving an authority up to a certain amount of issuance. What's the third thing you think we should be focusing on?
I think they really have to focus on who's allowed to have, at what level, who's allowed to have MSRs and who has to refrain from allowing people to have accumulate MSRs. I remember going into having a conversation back 5 years now, and I said, look, I mean, if you've got an issuer there who's retaining MSRs, you should be able to look at it and say, you know what, you really can't do that. We want you to liquidate those MSRs, or we want you to do this or that, so you can accumulate the liquidity for that until you get to a certain level. These programs aren't there. And here again, I'm not pointing the finger at Ginny because I love the program and I love the people. The problem is they don't have the personnel to be able to manage that type of environment. And that's really what's key. And, David, you look at $2 trillion and, we're sometimes when you say a trillion, you hear that number all the time over. And people don't really have any idea of what that really means. But I can tell you, if we have a problem in the Ginnie Mae portfolio of $2 trillion, we got a problem. The last thing we want to do is not be prepared
jeopardize
for that
program. And we're looking at what Mark Calabria is doing as the director of the FHFA and what he's planning to do with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I understand, divesting, get the taxpayer off of the hook for this. This program's different. This is inside of the of HUD. And so this program is here to stay as a government entity, and that I don't see that going away. Do you at all? Is there any chance of Ginnie Mae being spun out separately?
I go back to when when I was in office, and you know, my good friend Brian Montgomery was a FHA commissioner.
Yeah.
We talked about the benefits of spinning it out so it would be an independent agency, that it could be able to manage the expectations of the marketplace at the same time that it had the wherewithal to manage the risk of what was going on in the marketplace. And as long as, you know, it's like any other thing, you know, when it's tucked up under HUD, it doesn't get the attention that it needs to get, and it doesn't have the authority that it needs to have, and that's problematic. And you know, I now that you know, Brian is in a great position as deputy secretary. I mean, if he's able to retain that position, if the administration is reelected into office, I'm hoping that Brian is going to be instrumental in not only make some improvements to the FHA program, but also really, really take a hard look at doing this. But you know, I don't know of any HUD secretary that's willing to spin out Ginnie Mae from within itself. I mean, that's a tough thing for them to do, but in reality,
right,
it's really what needs to be done.
And I would love to go into that, but because that seems a bit of a fantasy, as practical and valuable as that would be, I'm not sure of the reality of that. And it's probably because of the political environment is where I want to go next. You know better than anybody what that job entails within Ginnie Mae. That is some of the hardest working people. I have tremendous respect for Greg Keith, Michael Drain, the guys on the line managing that. We just did an interview with Greg Keith and head of risk management there. I mean, head of all risk. And he, with the resources he has, he's trying to do his best to do that. But when I was asking him about some of these players that are approved, that some of the companies that are approved that are in there, and questioning about this, he says, we're not in a position. We're here, I mean, again, talking as, I'm not saying a bureaucrat in a negative sense, but they're part of the federal government. They're very aware of the constituency and the political aspect of this. So talk about that. The political environment that Ginnie Mae lives is almost fraught with so many problems that the very structure that it sits in is fraught with so many potential problems that I'm not sure that there's much hope for this change. Until something really happens, and then it's going to get a whole lot of attention, and that's not going to be good. That jeopardizes the program.
Well, I mean, that's what really raises my blood pressure is when I think of what could happen, the what ifs, you know, and you know, what happened if we have a catastrophic environment with the $2 trillion, and then what in God's name would we end up with when you get all these folks on the Hill trying to mold this new entity like Ginnie Mae? You never know what you're going to end up with, and that's problematic. And you're right. It can be a political – you know, Dave, when I came into office, the net worth requirement was $500,000. And I remember trying my best to get it to go to $2 million. And you just get your finger slapped. You can't do that. Well, why can't you do that? Well, because basically it becomes very political. There are constituency issues. There are, you know, is this going to be a program that's going to benefit this group of borrowers, that group of borrowers, you know, this group of consumers? That, you know, everybody's got their fingers in it, and everybody wants it to be what it is for right now, the way it is. Nobody wants any changes to be made to it. And then you look at it and say, but if you don't make the changes necessary to this, it may not be there tomorrow. You know, when I came into office, Ginnie Mae was producing $5 to $7, maybe $8 billion a month when I got into office. And then all of a sudden, because when they, you know, when the conservatorship happened, I mean, we went up to $75 billion a month. We didn't have the liquidity domestically to be able to have $75 billion a month in request. We had to go if we didn't go to the Asian marketplace to get that necessary liquidity, we'd have had a cluster, you know what, on our hands, you know, on a month-to-month basis. It truly saved the mortgage industry in 2008, 2009, because no one knew what the heck was going to go on with the GSEs. So everybody was putting all their eggs in that FHA or VA basket. And that's so it has such an importance to it that I would hope that you would get these consumer groups. You know, you have the Asian consumer group. You know, you've got the African-American consumer groups. You've got the Hispanic consumer groups, all these consumer groups, that their constituents in those consumer groups really depend for housing, whether it's multifamily or residential, with the Ginnie Mae programs. And you would, I would hope that they would sit back and say, you know, we got to do something here. We got to protect that because our constituency depends on a roof over their head that program is alive and well.
But the very ones that it's helping also because of the tenuous aspects of their credit profile is also puts the program at risk, which goes back to who should be involved in it. Is that an accurate statement?
That's an accurate statement. But you know what? Here again, I'll flip this around for you. The program was designed, first of all, let me step back. If I want to be in the VA business and I'm a lender and I'm doing VA loans, I'm in for a penny, I'm in for a pound because you're participating in the loss with the VA. Not so much in the FHA program, which is something that I think needs to be really evaluated at, okay? I'm not sure today what the maximum law out of pocket is for an FHA lender if they do everything right in a foreclosure. It used to be like $3,500 or $4,000, but, you know, that's chump change in today's marketplace. The VA, they'll steal your wallet if you're not careful in the VA program. So, so you got to have the right people making those loans, being issuers who have the wherewithal to be able to withstand those kind of losses. That's what makes Ginnie's program so nice. It doesn't go back and harm Ginnie Mae, in essence, like it does Fannie and Freddie in their program. You know, the taxpayers aren't paying for that. The issuers paying for that are on the line. So you got to have the right issuers issuing those bonds on behalf of those groups. But, you know, if you're saying I'm going to make loans to a veteran, and you got a veteran moving all over the damn world. If you're going to make a housing program for somebody in the FHA program, you have to anticipate that those borrowers are going to be in trouble a lot more than folks maybe in the conventional program. So you have to have the right people making those loans to those folks who can support a higher delinquency rate than you would have under the conventional programs. I'm not so sure, David, that that's the way it works today. I'm really
not. No, it doesn't. You're bringing up a great point because then it's who should be admitted into the program, who should be approved by Ginnie Mae, and it's those that know how to do. I wouldn't say it's specialty servicing per se, but it's certainly not the typical Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, a borrower that is better suited probably for a Fannie Mae program, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac program. So this is a more difficult loan. Talk about that. So you serve on the board of New Day USA, and it does a lot of VA refinancing. Talk about some of the lenders like them that do that type of specialty or focus on that. How do they prepare to handle this type of product versus a true paper lender who retains the MSRs?
You know, if you're going to be a FHA or a VA lender, you really have to understand that you have to understand and analyze the 1003. So every line in the 1003 is filled out, and you're going back now in time to the way we used to underwrite loans back 20, 30 years ago. Yep. And it's not a score. You know, to me, a 640 FICO score means nothing to me because I don't know the underlying support in that 640 FICO score. So if I look at someone's 1003, their 1003, and I look at their credit history, I may see this guy that he's late on a credit card payment or this, but you know what? He pays his rent on time every month or he pays his mortgage on time every month. That tells me that he understands the importance of who he owes. So he is not as much a risk as someone who doesn't. Very few people go back to the old line of underwriting to be able to do it. That's the one thing that we enjoy about serving on the New Day board with the veterans. You know, I'm a veteran. Admiral Tom Lynch is a veteran. General Jones is a veteran. Secretary Nicholson's a veteran. We're all veterans, and we hold the company to a certain standard. Yes, we want to make every loan we can to every veteran that we can make a loan to, but we have to make sure that that veteran has the wherewithal to meet those obligations. You're not going to put them in a loan that's going to absolutely blow up on them because you haven't done your homework. And that's the key. We should go back to a form of underwriting that we're really understanding what that profile of that borrower looks like because we're looking at it from every aspect we can, not putting this thing into some algorithmic black box, and all of a sudden it comes out and says, well, you're a 780 FICO score, or you're a 680, or you're a 620. That tells me nothing.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I've got my certification as a direct endorsed underwriter under the HUD program back in 1978. I love the VA residual income underwriting approach. I think it's probably one of the better approaches. I've always wondered when you put a formula to it, that works, I guess, maybe better in the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac programs. You have a more predictable score. But underwriting a veteran, underwriting especially a veteran who's gone through some difficulties, underwriting a HUD borrower who is buying their first home, there's other aspects that need to go into that underwriting. And it's just, you really bring up a great point. And I think as we look at who we approve and let into the system, into the Jenny Mae program specifically, not only should there be limits based on their net worth, their liquidity, but there also needs to be a clear demonstrated understanding of their ability to understand the program and the loans going into that program and how to service them. Let's get into the servicing part, the MSR part of it, because servicing a Jenny Mae pool does have some differences. If you would address that, just touch on that, some of the things that you have seen can make a difference in a well-serviced Jenny Mae pool versus one that's not.
There's nobody I respect more than Mark Helm. Mark has forgotten more about servicing than I'll ever even know. And I have a respect for him because in today's day and age, when I look at somebody who's, in my mind, the expert, it's a guy like Mark Helm. But I go back in time to guys like Tony Barone. If you remember a guy like Tony Barone.
Yeah,
Tony Barone. Tony Barone was an absolute expert at sniffing out a good deal because he grew up in the consumer finance era when everybody that made a loan was responsible for that loan and you had to learn how to manage the expectations. So you were responsible from the moment that thing, if the payment due was the 15th and that payment wasn't there on the 16th, you're on top of it. Or if you had a customer who was generally late, And they were due on the 15th, you start calling them on the 12th. Are you going to make your payment on the 15th? You know, today everything is so mechanized that, and I'm not saying it's all wrong. I'm just saying we've lost that touch that we used to have and the knowledge that goes along with that touch to be able to effectively service a loan. You know, I grew up in the banking business. That's where I used to run a bucket, 30, 60, 90 day bucket, calling that consumer every month. You learn to respect, you know, and they did that back in the day so that when you had loan authority, you paid attention. Remember the days when you were collecting the 30 and 60 day and 90 day bucket. And that's how we learned back in the 70s. So that doesn't happen today. And, you know, and you make an assumption that just because you're making a refi today, that refi is going to be good tomorrow. That's a bad assumption to make.
It really is. There's so many factors that go into how a loan is underwritten, into the program it goes into, and then more importantly, how that loan is serviced afterwards. I love what Ed Fay does at Fay Servicing. He's a specialty servicer and how he has stayed on top of that. Ed does a brilliant job of servicing loans. And because it is more of a specialty servicing, it's a product that he usually takes that's a discounted, it's deep, oftentimes high delinquencies in it. But he brings it current through this kind of practice. And that's the art that we've lost. And I'm really glad you're on your soapbox about that. And it brings up my favorite underwriting topic, which is the underwriting side. Let's get the right loans into the system. And I am concerned that lenders that are applying for this are doing so for their own liquidity. Let me get this. This is not just another secondary market that we deliver into. This is a special program that has a special purpose, and we cannot forget the purpose. How do we get that message to Congress? We have people on the Hill that listen to our podcast. What is the message you believe we should be bringing to the Hill on this topic?
Well, I mean, first of all, you've got to – you know, you got to get a group of people on the Hill that have an interest, have a true interest in doing what's right. And that's very difficult. I mean, in today's environment, I mean, it, you know, let's face it, David, it's very difficult. I mean, they'll be the first one to point a finger if something blows up. But, you know, were you sitting around thinking about the what ifs or how can we make this better? And everything that's touched now on the Hill is a political football. That's not the way we should be looking at this because there are a lot of constituents that are put in a bad situation because of poor underwriting or the lack thereof of underwriting. you know, we need the Hill to have meetings about this and committee meetings about this to really got to understand what's going on with this program. And it just isn't happening. And if there's many people that listen to your podcast on the Hill, you know, should be able to look at, listen to all these podcasts and say, you know, there's something to this. Maybe we should have a session just to learn a little bit more about this. And so that we're not stepping in this if something happens. And then we've got egg on our face, and the first thing we're going to do is run for cover and point fingers. All that does is it hurts the consumer.
Right.
If we have a blip in the Ginnie Mae program, it's going to hurt the people who need it the most. And that's the problem that I have. You know, I have an enormous amount of respect for our consumer groups, an enormous amount of it for hardworking people.
I said there's so many people that need this program, want this program, and we're in the amount of partisanship that's going on the Hill right now, I have probably the lowest hope. If this president, this current administration gets reelected, I'm highly confident they will be. Is there really hope? And then if so, what should they be focusing on? Is it having special hearings on this to be looking into this? What are the steps that you would recommend to them, Joe?
They need to start with special hearings. They need to get the people in there up in front of them who really have spent a lifetime in this business understanding what this business is all about, the risk of all this business, and how it harms or it benefits their constituency. And that's really what they should be doing. And you know what? There isn't. They'll play around this football of, you know, should we take Fannie and Freddie out of conservatorship? They went into conservatorship in 2008. I mean, that's
yes.
12 years ago. How long are they going to be in conservatorship? Why don't we put that aside and come to the terms on that? And let them loose. Now, I don't believe that the United States taxpayer has to pay for the mistakes of the programs that we had in Fannie and Freddie before the conservatorship. I think the Ginnie Mae program is probably the best constructed program in the business. You know, I mean, it gives the confidence to the bond buyers that there's catastrophic coverage, and yet Ginnie Mae is not responsible technically for that. The people that issue are responsible for that. So we need to look at that and say, is that the best way to do this? Is there a better way to be able to find ways to be able to have a more qualified issuer in place to be able to protect that? We don't have enough hearings to support what's really needed in the marketplace as it relates to the world of finance. And that, to me, is something that's lacking. There should be subcommittee meetings meeting all the time to figure out what the best solution for this is. Looking at all the what ifs. The what ifs are so important. And, you know, I think we might have got into this one day when we were talking at our Ainsworth meeting. Does anybody really think about the what ifs in our business? It's hard for me.
Not nearly as much as they need to. That is for sure.
David, you and I know we've been around a long time. And I love the mortgage industry because it does so. It provides such a benefit to consumers. You know, it puts a roof over someone's head. There's nothing more important than having a family be able to move into a home. And yet you and I have tried to talk to the folks in the mortgage industry over the years. And I have an old saying, mortgage bankers are either too busy or too sad. There's never an in-between.
Yeah.
There's never an in-between.
When you we understand the too busy. Talk about the too sad. Explain that a little bit.
I know what you mean,
but I want our listeners to know it.
If they're not running 1,000% every day and they're too busy, if they falls off in business and they're wondering where the next deal's coming from, they kind of sit there and they're too sad. You know? I mean, there's no middle market for these guys in their emotional state. I mean, in our industry, and it's.
Well, that's why I think there's so much. What is the answer? Is it an education program? Is it requiring some type of certification? I was literally on the talking to one of the senior execs at Fannie Mae about this. Our firm, Transformational Mortgage Solutions, which I'm proud to say Mark Helm is now very deep in a part of that, as he is Ainsworth Advisors. And we were talking about this. And I really believe there should be more education. I mean, I love what the MBA is doing, applauding that. But there needs to be more in a readiness program to prove you're ready. I mean, you look at what people have to do in other areas to get certified. Dear God, to be an appraiser now, to be any some of the other service industries out there, it's way over. We do not have the proper training.
You know, it's too easy to become a mortgage broker or a mortgage lender. Generally what happens generally what happens is you have a very effective salesperson in an organization, and that salesperson looks around and says, well, I need to start my own business. Okay, so they go out and they start their own brokerage firm or whatever, but their concentration is on sales.
Right.
They really don't concentrate on the rest of their business, the back room, the underwriting. Just get the deal done. Let's get the deal done. Let's get the deal done. I got a pipeline. Let's get the deal done. I need 10 loans this month. I need 20 loans this month. You know, I've got to keep my nose above the waterline. But nothing really happens to look at this as a business. It's a business from the moment the application comes in until the loan is paid off at some point in time. You know, it's a business, and it stops generally because the lack of knowledge or the lack of desire by the person who started the business to go beyond the sale. It's a big business.
Going back to one of the original points you made at the beginning, this provides liquidity. It's one of the most important liquidity programs that are out there. But if you're just seeing the program as a vehicle to liquidity and not understanding the risk involved in this liquidity program, you're setting yourself up, or you're setting the system up, which is really concerning. We both share a passion on this, for a particular catastrophic failure. And if that happens,
right,
like you say, all the people that most benefit from this are going to be the losers, the greatest losers in it. So I think it's important to understand, in addition to, yes, this is a great liquidity program, but think past the liquidity. What is special about it? And you're raising some of the best points I've heard talked about in a long time. I hope this gets listened to on the Hill. I'm going to do my job pushing it out there. We got a great program, folks. Jenny May issues right now, as of May 8th, 2020, the outstanding increased to $2.19 trillion. That
right.
is a program that is speaking to, I mean, and you weren't there that many years ago. I mean, it was in 2000, if I'm looking at your profile here, you were 2008 to 2009. And back then,
right,
you were saying it was $860 billion. Now we're at
right.
$2.1 trillion. This is a testimony to the power of this program, how it can help homeowners. But I, too, share your passion that I am very concerned about this, and we need you back on the program. Please take care of your health. Please be willing to stay involved. But, I mean, I know we do get older. I'm turning 70 this year. We got to start educating the next generation. So who should we be looking at to pick up this baton? Who would be your recommendation? Name names, or at least give me a profile, probably the better way to go.
Every company around needs a little bit of gray hair in it, you know? Somebody with experience.
Yep.
I couldn't hold a candle to some of the brilliance that some of these young folks have, and they are smart and they're educated, but they don't know what they don't know because they haven't spent a
yeah.
lot of time in it. They don't have a lot. They've never licked any wounds. They don't know, and they very, very, very seldom ever think about the what ifs. And
right.
I will guarantee you, as sure as I'm standing here, sitting here today, that I'll say less than 5% of the mortgage industry out there had a pandemic plan in place.
Right. I agree. Yeah. Regulated as depositories had to. They've thought through that. Most depositories actually had a pandemic. But they have a discipline. The regulators are on them, examining them. Where is this plan, that plan? So they understand that. Independents do not. And that's what's recreated, again, because of we have $2.149 trillion in this program, which is we now have the PTAP, the pass-through.
Thank God for PTAP, but that's a very restrictive program. Have you ever read the requirements? I mean, that's really restrictive. I mean, and I understand why Ginny and Treasury are doing it. I'm fine with it, but you really got to be desperate to take on the PTAP program because there's a lot of restrictions. But, you know, I mean, from the standpoint of you've got to get people to, and maybe, you know, maybe, and I'm not saying for sure because I'll get a lot of pushback on this. Maybe the mortgage industry needs to be regulated. I hate to say that.
I know. I am feeling I've been so against regulation. I've been so anti it. But I am now. Maybe it's because we're getting older, Joe, when we look at the importance of having some training wheels. Either we get some education and certifications in place to prove that you are able to do there, or if you fail to self-regulate from within, you must be regulated from without, or this program is going to blow up. And I cannot believe I'm saying that as a registered Republican who is anti.
But listen,
against this.
We both know that we better self-regulate, because if someone else regulates, we're not going to like it.
That's right.
It won't be the same industry. So we better, right now, I think the mortgage bankers of America are the tip of the spear when it comes to this stuff. And I know that they've got, I understand the politics of the NBA, but if not them to start, who then? To be able to figure out how to educate and how to self-regulate. Because if that doesn't, David, I'm telling you, sure as God, I'm standing here. If something blows up with that $2.19 trillion of outstandings at Ginnie Mae, all hell will break loose inside the Beltway. And it won't be good for anybody.
It's not going to be good for anybody. Well, I hope we get some stir up some thinking on this, and hopefully get past this election and get serious about looking at this program. I want to thank you we're recording this just before Memorial Day. And Joe, first of all, I want to thank you for your service as a veteran. I want to thank you for your service, civil service, inside of our government with Jenny May, serving as the president of Jenny May. I also want to thank you for your passion to make programs like this viable and ongoing for generations to come. Appreciate you. I value you at so many levels, personally and professionally. I want to say thank you, sir.
It's a pleasure, David. Anytime for you, I'd be happy to come on board and talk about the things that irritate me every day.
Well, I think we need to get a little stirred up. It's okay. It's fun to find a couple old guys getting stirred up on these things, because it is important, because it's not about us. It's not us making a name. It's really about the next generation. And, folks, we got to preserve this system. $2.149 trillion. We have got to protect this. It is a real, I think you said it so well at the beginning, this program is a gift. Joe Murin, thank you so much for being here with us today.
My pleasure, David. Thank you.
And maybe I'll put a good point in at this point. Listeners, go over to Ainsworth Advisors. I would almost say that this particular podcast is sponsored by Ainsworth Advisors. But the reason I founded Ainsworth Advisors is because of this very thing. I was a young mortgage banker. I've been involved as an owner, operator, president, CEO of two of the companies. I wish to God I would have had an Ainsworth Advisory Group that I could call on. As you grow your business, I encourage you to head out to that website, ainsworthadvisors.com. Look at the profiles of the individuals in there. I'm so honored to have friendships and invite these people in. Gary Ortz is pretty much running that for me on my behalf, because I'm so busy with Transformational Mortgage Solutions. He's doing a great job. We've got Joe Murin in there. We have Jay Brinkman in there. We've got Mark Helm, and you are so right, Joe. That man has forgotten more than most people will ever know about servicing. And the best part, he's such a humble guy. He is just so willing to share. He's done so well financially, yet he's out there every day giving back and literally helping lenders hold their hands, get them approved, working with me on it. Such an honor. So check out the Ainsworth Advisors, everybody. Joe, again, thank you for being a part of that organization. Let's see if we can't use this podcast to get some people fired up and consider a Ainsworth board for their company. Thank you, sir. Have a great Memorial Day.
You do the same, David. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Love that podcast. Enjoyed Joe's interview. I hope you did. Share it with others, and especially share it on the Hill. We need to get the word out that this is a special program, and we're so grateful to have Joe Murin be still involved in the industry. Us old gray hairs still going and making a difference. Next week we have Next week we got Matt Graham of MBS Live, who will be joining us. He's again part of our regular podcast now. He's one of the regulars. We're going to get to know Matt a little bit better and what makes MBS Live so special. So be sure to come back here next week. I want to say a special thank you to all of our sponsors: Finastra, CMLA, the Community Mortgage Lenders of America, as well as Indicom, Accelerate, Ainsworth Advisors, Mobility RE, Modex, and so many others. Check out all of our sponsors on our sponsorship page. Thank you so much. Have a great week, everybody, and look forward to talking to you next week.
You've been listening to Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lickin of Transformational Mortgage Solutions. Join us next week, and thanks for listening.